Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's private equity practice. Today, we're privileged to be joined by Eric Taylor, who's the founder and CEO of Trident, and Jeff Roth, who's the founding partner of Bruin Capital. We'll release two parts of the conversation with Jeff and Eric over the next couple weeks. And in this first episode, we'll learn more about the two of them, their respective sourcing strategies, and value creation methods. Part B will include a discussion on the current deal environment and a look ahead, as well as how they work with founders and operators in their portcos. Now, just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with all that out of the way, I think we can kick it off here. So Jeff, I'll have you get us started. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your role at Bruin Capital, and how your firm has built a portfolio around what you call the second level enablers of sports and entertainment. Would also be interested to hear kind of where that thesis stands today as you deploy your new $1 billion fund.
Sure, sounds great. And thanks for having me today, Todd.
You bet.
So as background, I'm a founding partner of Bruin Capital. I lead the investment team. We launched the firm in 2015 with a $300 million investment vehicle. Our current vehicle that we're investing out of is over $1 billion. And as you said, it's second level enablers or sports adjacencies. So we invest in sports related businesses. It's picks and shovels or the kind of the operating companies that support the sports ecosystem. So that can be software and services, broadcast technology, marketing and data services, stadium infrastructure, content production, talent agencies, a lot of B2B businesses, but also some B2C businesses that support the sports ecosystem. Our portfolio companies today are very global. They operate in more than 100 offices in 21 countries. We're a firm all out of New York, but 80% of our invested capital has actually been invested in businesses that are headquartered outside of the U.S. A couple quick examples. We invested in one of our earlier businesses, a business called DeltaTray, which technology and media services. They sold products to leagues, teams, and media companies. We helped them drive a lot of growth in the U.S. When we acquired the business, it was about 60 of revenue. It grew to 200 million of revenue, and half of that growth was in the U.S. A similar story with Two Circles, which is a data-driven marketing services business, sold services to leagues and teams. Similar U.S. growth story. We drove acquisitions there and developed some new revenue models for new markets. TGI is virtual advertising. We have a business called Box to Box. It does content production. They do a lot of the unscripted shows. Playgreen or SGL has grow lights to help support the grass conditions on soccer pitches or rugby or cricket or stadium. So it's grow lights and a software platform to help optimize the grass conditions. In all of our deals, we partner with existing management teams. We rarely, if ever, are looking to kind of insert our own management teams or replace existing teams. It's a partnership model. We're always looking for those opportunities where the existing team wants to stay on and roll. And it's just looking for a partner that can help grow the business in new markets. Typical equity check is 50 million to 200 million. We can do less if it's a tuck-in or more with co-investors. And we generally do majority, but we're very open to minority. But we really pride ourselves on being management team and entrepreneur friendly. We help drive growth. We don't step on toes and run the businesses ourselves, but we're looking to leverage our relationships in sports and media and our sector knowledge in the space globally to help drive new growth areas.
All right, Jeff. Eric, I'll pose the same question to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your role at Trident, and how you built a private equity firm around the small business market. And, you know, we'd also love to hear more about why you believe it's one of the most under-leveraged opportunities in the asset class.
Thanks, Todd. And I just want to say thank you to the BDO team for having me aboard. I'm going to talk maybe about two things. The first is what we are at Trident. The second is who we are, because I think it really contextualizes what we think gives us edge. In terms of what we are a control-oriented buyout firm. We focus on family-owned small businesses in the U.S. So we describe that as $10 to $100 million in revenues, roughly $2 to $25 million in EBITDA across three core sectors. That's healthcare, consumer, and industrials. We like to tell people that we invest in red-blooded American companies. In terms of how we find these businesses, we've never actually done a banked auction deal process here. We'll spend a little bit more time on sourcing later, but we take great pride in trying to find operators who serve as sort of central nodes that can contextualize our relationship with a family that's selling a business. And so our job is to take that business from a business that has maybe never had any sort of institutional investment, has never, had to exist in a leveraged environment, and effectively ferry it across this river into the arms of other private equity firms. And in between, what we're trying to do is build infrastructure that we know will serve it well in the future. So that's what we are. In terms of who we are, I grew up all over this country. So I was born in Detroit. I grew up in East Baltimore, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Southern Texas, right near the Mexican border. I went to boarding school in New England. And so I have these experiences throughout my life of sitting with small business entrepreneurs around the Thanksgiving table. And it happened basically everywhere that I lived, whether it was folks who owned gas stations or restaurants or small, industrials businesses or healthcare businesses. I think I just took a lot of pride in knowing them and watching them work and watching them pour all their blood and sweat into their businesses. And so for us, it's not just about, buying a company and growing it. We really try to learn and understand what part of that family's DNA makes that company tick, and how can we maintain that, but at the same time, maybe offer some tools that we know all too well can help companies grow. And balancing those two things, I think, is very important, but it can only be done, I think, if you have an appreciation for what it took to get those businesses there. And for us and many of my colleagues, that appreciation was created over time. Appreciation wasn't created just from sort of, reading about businesses. We watched family members and family friends grow small businesses over a long period of time. That love for the game for us, I think, is really a driving force in what we do and how we do it.
Yeah. Well, Eric, it's great to have you on. You clearly bring a unique perspective. So thanks for joining us. So now that our listeners have some context into both of your backgrounds, I'd love to dig a little deeper and learn more about your sourcing methods and models. Both of your firms have built sourcing models that you seem to be proud of. So, Eric, I'm going to come to you first. Trident uses a proprietary technology to systematically identify and diligence small-cap opportunities. Perhaps you can tell us how that works in practice and how it complements the relationship side of the business.
Sure, of course. We have really tried to break down the process that a family goes through when selling the business, not just emotionally, but literally. Who's the first call? And while I think consultants, bankers, lawyers will eventually get a call, we think ultimately that call is going to go to a family friend. And so our process is really broken down into three parts, and we think every private equity firm does this, but here's ours. Most folks look at a deal, they then underwrite that deal, and then they staff that deal with great operators. So three-part process: deal, underwriting or thesis creation, then operators. We do things the opposite way. First, we try to figure out who the best and brightest within a particular subsector and particular region are, and we try to build relationships with them. The second part of our process is actually trying to use those relationships and use those conversations to build great theses. Because what happens when you're talking to somebody who has so much subsector knowledge is something that is fairly obvious to them, they will not know how much value can be created from just that little kernel of information. And then we go into actually finding deal flow. And what eventually happens in that process is, as we are talking to that operator and as we're building that thesis, by the time it's time to look for a potential opportunity, you're actually realizing that that operator has really good insight into local families within that particular subsector who might be looking to sell their business or move on or retire or what have you. And instead of us going to a banker meeting and trying to bring an operating partner along to make us look smarter, it's that operating partner bringing us along and saying, hey, you know, we know each other. We may have known each other for 10, 15 years. These are good guys. Let's have a conversation. It just, I think, allows for us to show up in a uncompetitive space, but still move relatively quickly and with conviction, and also drive conviction on the part of that family who's looking to part with something that has really been a part of their identity for many years in many cases. So that's kind of our process in a nutshell.
All right. I appreciate that, Eric. So Jeff, similar question for you. Bruins deal flow is built on a network that's been cultivated over decades in sports. As the person responsible for structuring and executing those deals, what does the sourcing process actually look like once an opportunity comes through the door? And how do you decide what's worth pursuing?
And so it used to be a lot harder when we were getting started in 2014, whether it was investment bankers or LPs, what investing in sports wasn't really clear to a lot of people. We had a thesis around, like I mentioned before, the picks and shovels and sports adjacencies, but we're very sector focused. But that said, not every business we look at screams, this is a sports business, like a sports rights business or a sports marketing business. It might be more of an infrastructure or industrial business that just serves sports stadiums as one of their end markets. So on one hand, we're specific to sports as an end market, but what those businesses look like in their revenue models, sometimes they're more consumer oriented, sometimes more industrial oriented. So we kind of have to cast a wide net in some ways when you think about the market like that. So it used to be harder when we were getting started, but I'd say over the last 12 years or so, just given the reputation we built in the market around the types of deals that we do and our value creation playbook, it's still not easy, but it's certainly gotten easier in that sometimes, not every time, deal opportunities will come to us. We also maintain a very broad list of, I think, over 70 bankers and consultants and advisors that we're in touch with at least once a quarter. And that's not always to, you know, but if we find out about it when the business is in process, that's fine. We'll participate in processes, but we're more so maintaining that network to get ideas and receive introductions earlier. And because we cast a global net, we're US, Europe, Western Europe, Australia, for the most part, we need to have wide breadth of relationships of people we keep in touch with. And sometimes that's a sports coverage banker at a large bank. Other times it's a middle market bank. Other times it's doing sponsor coverage. Other times it's more of a consultant, or even like I mentioned before, an industrial banker sometimes will show us a deal. That's how we found the Playgreen and SGL. We do proactively reach out to founders and management teams and existing owners, particularly when we find a business we like. We have a long list of a watch list, and we tier a pipeline, tier one, two, and three. And we try to foster long-term relationships with founders and CEOs, even if the business might be too early now. So we're proactively maintaining those relationships. We'll do a white papers and come up with competitive analyses in certain sectors we like, for example, broadcast technology or stadium infrastructure or youth sports. We'll kind of dig into the underlying market and then distill it down to a set of key players that we'll reach out to. So we do spend a lot of time sourcing and originated. We have a pretty organized and concerted effort that kind of runs top of house all the way down to VPs and associates. We also think another thing that makes us unique is we have a dozen Bruin advisors, and these are kind of senior executives who we touch base with at least monthly. And they're either current or former high level sports, media, live event, ecosystem type executives that have really good connectivity. So they'll occasionally have insights that lead directly or indirectly to a deal idea that can be helpful on the diligence side, but really sourcing is an important part of the role that they play for us. And then in terms of is it worth pursuing, we need to make very quick decisions because we do generally have a pretty big top of funnel pipeline. So we're pretty quick about like a red, yellow, green type scorecard on the initial insights. We don't retrade terms. If we deliver a term sheet, we want to have conviction early. We're not price chipping at the end. So we want to be firm and clear in our decision and view up front. And we think we're able to because we're investing in a pretty specific space that we have a lot of intelligence and experience in. The businesses have to be profitable, so we can't invest in earlier stage businesses. durable, stable core business. We really need to see growth opportunities. If it's a great business, that might, be a great business for a family to own, but it's a 3% grower, that's not really a fit for us. We need to really be able to double EBITDA in a 3 to 5 year period while also seeing a pretty core, stable business. And the key thing for us is also we need to see a Bruin value add. So we've seen strong businesses that we like, but just aren't a fit for us. If we can't point to a couple areas of tangible growth outside the plan that we can add, it won't be a fit for us. And usually that's revenue focused. So we of course look to, optimize costs and run businesses more efficiently when we can, but our value add and what we underwrite to is really additional revenue growth on top of the plan that we're able to unlock given our knowledge of the sector and kind of global opportunities and our relationship with key sports properties. We'll sometimes even softly test that value add during the diligence. And for example, if it's a B2B business selling to leagues, we've got great relationships with all the leagues globally. We can kind of get a feel for who their current provider is in that area, if they're open to a new provider. So we can get a really good sense during the diligence process on whether that value add is real or it's more so theoretical.
All right, Jeff, appreciate your detailing all of that for us. I want to stay on the investment life cycle for a moment with both of you. Once a deal gets done, the conversation quickly shifts from sourcing to execution. Everyone's trying to figure out the formula to create value, accelerate growth, and position assets for long-term success. So I really like this next question, having hosted a bunch of these podcast episodes. I always like to give our listeners kind of some sound bites and key takeaways, and think this topic's going to bring that out of you guys. So, Jeff, I'm going to start with you on this one. After you've made an investment, what's one move, operational, commercial, or structural, that generated more impact than you expected? And what did it teach you about where value actually gets created in your respective markets?
For us, and I kind of hinted at this in my last response, it's really about opening doors in the sports world, particularly globally. Like, we found a ton of businesses that might be based in Italy or Germany or the US that are kind of middle market businesses that just, again, operate in the sports or live event space. And for that business, that might be 30 or 40 of top line or 10, 20 of EBITDA. Really hard for a business like that to plant a flag in a new market. There's tax complexity, there's cultural norms, there's other competitors in those markets. So we're able to lend credibility for businesses when they're growing internationally or getting more penetration in their core markets. But particularly the unlock we found is helping some of these businesses grow globally. And I could spend all day on this, but where a lot of sports leagues are looking for that next frontier of growth is by internationalizing their business, whether that's doing a lot more games internationally or soccer properties in Europe trying to grow their audience in the US. And we support the businesses that enable that. So unlocking those new relationships and clients is important. It's just a lot harder for a smaller middle market family business to break into a new country or a new sport. So we lend that credibility. We help internationalize the business. If they're pitching in a new market for a new client and they lose, we're able to get in there and find out the real and why they lost. We can help tailor the go-to-market strategy. You need to kind of tailor the go-to-market strategy and the product and service so we can go on a listening tour and find out where the pain points are for the end market and help tailor that pitch. So a lot of it is opening doors, adding growth levers that aren't in the management case that either de-risk the plan if something doesn't work or adds fuel if things are going well. The other thing I'd say is we have a zero loss ratio, which I think speaks to the fact that we really do invest in businesses that we can tangibly improve. So we have good upside and good returns, but we've never lost money on a deal because, again, we're investing in businesses that we know that we can bet on ourselves if the company hits a speed bump that we can help reorient or turn around. One example, a business called DeltaTre, which we acquired. It was an Italian business. I think I may have mentioned it before, $60 million of revenue when we acquired it, $200 million when we exited. Their first deal that they won was from a major US federation to run all of their websites. And we got a call from the deputy commissioner saying, "How can I hire an Italian business I've never heard of to run all of my websites?" And he said, "Well, if something goes wrong, you know where we are, you know who to call, and we'll fix it." And that was good enough for them. And that was the first of many this business won in the US. Beyond the revenue side, I think I'd say we're as focused as others in terms of optimizing businesses and driving efficient operations, using the balance sheet and debt, structuring deals well, particularly tuck-ins with earnouts if we need to. We do a lot of tuck-in acquisitions to create value at accretive multiples. Those are funded sometimes with earnouts and find ways to incent the management team to stick around. So we do a lot of that. We know where the wind is blowing in sports and what's important to the end market, and whether it's consumers or leagues or teams, that helps guide the strategic direction. So I'd say we do a lot of the traditional private equity value creation, but really what separates us from others, I think, is that ability to really drive revenue growth. And in all of our exits, we've received multiple expansion. You know, obviously there's a little luck in that, but I'd like to also think that, you know, we're creating not only larger businesses, but higher quality businesses, more diverse, and that's leading to better outcomes and value creation.
Yeah, good stuff. Thanks for sharing, Jeff. So, Eric, what about you? Once the deal closes, where have you seen the greatest opportunities to create value? And can you share an operational, commercial, or structural initiative that delivered more impact than expected and explain why it was so effective?
Sure. You know, just a continuation of what I was talking about on sourcing, management, management, management. To do something very, very thoughtful here, we have to come in with our big ideas, sometimes with our city slick suits, and tell a business and its employees that have been running that way successfully and growing in some instances like 20, 25 plus percent CAGRs that we can do better. And it sounds ridiculous even when you say it, because it kind of is. We have to figure out how to put the right team in place without replacing too many people, because again, you don't want to get rid of that DNA. We have to come up with a way to put the right ideas in place, again, without putting too many ideas in place, because you don't want to overwhelm the business. And you want to do that all while being sensitive to the feelings and the emotions of the people on the ground that have gotten you there. And the only way to do that well is with a great management team. So that's the first and most important thing I would say. Our relationships with these families, our relationships with their kids, our relationships with the management team, that's usually what will win. In terms of specifics, the second obvious thing that always improves our ability to manage a business post-transaction close, you know, you'd be surprised how many small business owners are not able to properly report or record financials. And I'm talking about companies that are doing 5, 10 plus million bucks of EBITDA. And the financials may be wrong, which means that there's little to no KPI reporting. And so going from maybe a monthly or quarterly financial picture of your business to all of our companies actually report KPIs on a weekly basis is a massive, massive difference in your ability to be agile when managing that business. I'll give you a couple examples. You know, we've got a company that makes school lunches for kids. It's based in Northern California, and we have grown it by over 50% from a revenue perspective in the first 18 months. And part of the reason is because of the things that we really like about the business. It's got a great brand. It's making fresh, scratch-made food every day. It's giving parents the optionality of picking between four or five different options daily. Built great relationships with the schools. I mean, all the above, right? But what happens over time is commodity costs go up and down, schools' preferences change. And so you need to be able to switch different specific commodity items out. The problem is, if you are not properly recording all of the inventory and recording and understanding, you know, if I switch 4 ounces of chicken out for 4 ounces of turkey per the school's request, what does that do to my margins? How does that impact my ability to continue to be profitable? If you're not paying attention to stuff like that, you can have misses. Or you, even worse, you can miss opportunities. And so that's an example of where, you know, yes, we brought in new management. We're continuing to partner with that family, obviously, but we're bringing in new tactics and techniques that really start with just basic key performance indicator monitoring, making sure we're monitoring working capital. And that then allows us to be more creative down the line in terms of making sure that our mix is good, and therefore making sure that we're ultimately serving the customer a lot better. And you can see all of that, all, you know, all those, that's downstream. You can see that in our working capital days. You can see that in our margin. most importantly, you can see it in top line, which means that the kids are eating more healthy food and the parents are happy. So all of these goals meet if you do it right.
All right, Eric. Well, I appreciate you sharing your insights. Listeners, that's going to do it for part A of this conversation. In a couple of weeks, we'll pick up with part B of the conversation to dive a little deeper in with Eric and Jeff. We're planning to discuss where they're finding opportunities in the current environment, learnings from working with their Portco operators, and what they expect as we inch closer to 2027. So, Jeff and Eric, I know you guys are super busy. I really appreciate you joining us today, and I'm looking forward to covering more ground in the next part of our discussion.
Thanks, Todd.
Appreciate partnership with BDO. You guys always do great work for us, and it was great to be here today.
All right, guys. Again, thank you. To our listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.